You can't delegate digital transformation for your company. You and your executives have to own it. Executives need to engage, embrace, and adopt new ways of working with the latest in emerging technologies. And that's where we come in. Welcome to Embracing Change. The business world is changing at a faster pace than it ever has, and companies need to keep up. We interview the most interesting CEOs, CMOs, and other executives to talk about their challenges with digital transformation in their industry. This is Embracing Change, and this is your host, Gerardo Carrick.
Hi everyone, welcome to Embracing Change. In this episode, I talk to Gaston Vanetti, Senior Vice President of Brands at Cox Communications, about some of the challenges established brands have in mobilizing internal resources to respond to changes in the marketplace. We discussed many topics, from mapping a customer's journey to the complexities of translating brand values into the user experience. I hope you enjoy it. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Embracing Change, Season 2, Episode 3. Our guest today is Gaston Vanetti, Senior VP of Brand Communications at Cox in Atlanta, Georgia. Gaston has an amazing brand strategy and brand management experience. He's managed groups across different regions in companies like Newell's, Unilever, now with Cox. In the past, he's been in strategic positions in planning, in advertising. So he has an amazing experience. And the reason we wanted to invite Gaston is because he has such a strategic mind, and he's so good at thinking very complex problems and simplifying them to try to marshal resources and marshal organizations towards achieving those goals. So we thought it would be very interesting to talk about some of the challenges that digital transformation brings to large organizations. So Gaston, how are you? Welcome.
Doing great, Gerardo. Very good to see you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. As I said, you're connecting from Atlanta, but why don't you let our audience know a little bit more about yourself, a little bit more than what I could do in 15 seconds.
Okay. So I'm originally from Argentina, and I moved to the US about 20 years ago. I did most of my career at a company called Unilever that some of your audience may be familiar with, working in a variety of business, but many brands that people would be familiar for with, like Dove, Axe, Degree. Also worked in food businesses at Unilever, both in Latin America and based in New York, but mostly working for other regions, a lot of work for Asia, Europe, and other places. And that's kind of my school. That's where I learned how to work in places before.
It's a fantastic brand school. I mean, it's for anybody who's in marketing, Unilever is one of the companies that provide such a platform for marketing to flourish, right? It's a great school to learn.
Yes. Yes, I agree. It's a huge privilege, and also I was very lucky to be working out of New York in a particular point in time. I worked with a couple of the most legendary marketers of the generation before me. So being able to work for people that were so much better than I am is a phenomenal learning opportunity and inspiration. Two people that were remarkable. Silvia Lagnado is one. She has many amazing accomplishments, but she's very famous for having created the campaign for Real Beauty for Dove.
Wow!
And being part of that journey, and that happened as I was working in that team. I can't take any credit for it. I was there as it was happening.
You were part of the team. You were part of the team.
I was part of the team. I may have had one or two ideas, but not the most important ones for sure. Most of the big ideas were hers, and seeing her lead through that what now seems like a very reasonable and smart thing to do, but at the time seemed incredibly risky and out of the box. So it was great. I was working for a guy called Steve Miles, who at the time was leading up a brand that's very big in Asia. Maybe it's big here, but maybe less known. Vaseline in Asia is a much richer brand, and we did a lot of our work for Asia and Africa and Europe. Steve Miles then went on to lead the Dove brand through the last few years, and a lot of the great advertising that people may remember from the last decade from Dove is work that he did before retiring a couple of years ago. So two unbelievable marketers, and having had the privilege of working for him, for them. I will always strive to be as good as they are.
Of course.
I'll probably never get there. So Unilever, basically my school, and then I moved to Atlanta with a Unilever team to work in a company called Newer Brands. Company best known for a bunch of brands like Sharpie and Graco and Rubbermaid and a bunch of durables. Did that for a few years. And then I got what I have today, which is a dream job that you want to have when you grow up in a company like Unilever. A company like Unilever is a place where everybody knows what to do. And there's a playbook for everything. And you're surrounded by people that are experts in their fields. So you make your small contribution, but you don't really own anything. You're just one gear in the system. When I was brought into Cox is a cable company, traditionally mostly an internet provider. It's a big brand, a $13 billion brand. So big brand, even for Unilever standards, bigger than any Unilever brand individually. And the opportunity to lead the brand and decide what the brand's going to be and how the brand's going to act. So finally, after years of training around everybody telling you what to do, it's your turn to decide what to do. So a dream opportunity for me.
Of course. So let's dive a little bit deeper on that, because I think your journey is very, very interesting in the sense of you've worked with consumer brands, right? And it's basically widgets, right? I mean, you're selling something that people buy and use. And then you join a company that it's a very interesting company, very well-known company, privately owned, by the way, right? It's not a public company. It's a family business, but it's run like a public company in how professional they are. But you're selling a service, right? So you've moved from product to service. So I would love to first kind of like get a peek into what are the challenges for transitioning, you know, for somebody who's been working with a product that you can actually hold and try and show to somebody, to then working on a brand that what it's providing, it's a service, and the service is way less abstract, right? It's not something you can hold.
It's concrete.
That's right.
You don't have a physical expression. Yep.
It's something that has so much more emphasis on the experience rather than on the delivery. What were the big challenges there?
Yep. There are a couple of there's some chunks of my expertise that became completely irrelevant. A big chunks of my expertise, like a lot of my career, I learned how to design a lot at Unilever, a lot more at Newell Brands with durable products. So design, physical design, and having a sense of taste and good logic for functionality and design, all of that completely irrelevant now. A lot of my time spent understanding the retail in packaged goods and how to make the business work for Walmart and how to make the business work for Target, all
shelf
irrelevant
strategies, you know, shelf strategy, trade marketing,
all of that mostly irrelevant. I would say, as it relates to the content itself, the biggest change is a huge jump in accountability. At the business that I'm at today, we know by name every customer in the places of the country that we cover. We know who they are. We know who their provider is. And we can pin down exactly what happens with every marketing action that we have which is much harder to do in packaged goods. You know, in packaged goods, you put a TV ad out there, and it's very difficult to tie that back to a person making a decision in the shelf. The whole data system is looser. Our data system in my current business is very, very tight. So the level of accountability is a lot higher. The information that I have is a lot richer, more precise. And it's the learning cycle is a lot tighter. I do stuff and I know if it worked or didn't. I really, really know if it worked or didn't work with a pretty high degree of precision, which is humbling many times and, and also a great learning experience.
Of course.
I said from a content standpoint, that was a biggest change. Now, when I look at the challenge, I would say the biggest challenge was, and maybe we should talk a little bit about what I was recruited to do. But the biggest challenge was credibility. I walked into an industry where 98% of the people that I work with grew up in this industry. So everybody is a 30-year veteran in the industry, and also in a company with very long tenure. So everybody's been for a very long time in this company. So when you're operating surrounded by people that have 20 years of experience in the industry, in the company, it's extremely hard to have credibility. There's so many things that everybody knows and you don't know that is very difficult to end. And I was brought to do fairly bold work. So being able to progress with the work despite not having earned credibility from the people around me. And as I earned credibility, trying to earn it as fast as I could in order to continue to push the agenda and the work that I wanted to get done. So the whole credibility thing, you know, whatever new thing I was proposing, people could always say, well, you don't understand the business.
Right? Yeah. So I mean, that's really, really interesting. And that ties in exactly with what the topic of this podcast is, which is embracing change. And you basically were brought in and you were a change agent in a way, right? I mean, you're in this business and what you're describing is, you know, there's around you people that have been in business around for so, you know, for a long time. They know what they're doing. They built a successful business, yet there's a future that we need to address, right? That might require different thinking. And here you are, you're coming in, you haven't proven yourself in this environment, but you're tasked with the challenge of, okay, what's next, right? What could we be doing different? How do you influence, or how can you be able to facilitate people around you that have been in an environment like this to embrace change, to think differently, to allow themselves to try something? How does that work?
So I would say, I'm going to speak about this specific job and how it worked for me. I think it's different in every case. There were a couple of, so first is sort of skip to the end. I managed to do a lot of what I wanted to do, a lot. So I'm very pleased with being able to change the direction of things more than I expected, probably. Now, the couple of things that were key. One is the guy that hired me. I chose to work for a company. I chose to work for a guy. And I didn't make a mistake there. That was probably the most important good decision that I made walking into this. The guy that hired me, my boss until recently, he is phenomenally good. He's a former Unilever guy. He understood how you manage a good quality brand. So he knew what good brand management looked like. He brought me in as an SVP of brands, and he had a sense of what success could be. He had a clear mission for me. He had a sort of very short way to express it. He said, we're a huge company with a company name, but we don't have a brand. Your job is to turn the company name into a brand and everything that comes with that. And he is he had built credibility. So he came into the company 5 years ahead of me, had built his own credibility. He was very decided and determined to turn the name into a brand and to foster a culture of customer centricity and brand centricity. So I knew I had both the support, but also the skill set and the ability and the understanding from him. And he's very good. He's the best boss I've ever had.
Okay, so that's important to have the support of an executive member, right? Have a sponsor, almost a sponsor in a way.
And nothing beats working for an outstanding boss, like working for really smart people. And the opposite is true. There's nothing worse than working for a fool. Right? It's fantastic to work for a very good boss, which is what's the case. He's now the CEO of the company very recently, but he's been my boss all through the 7 years I've been at Cox. So that was key. The other key thing is I found two and then three people at the company that had a lot of experience in the company, a lot of credibility that I recruited into my team. Mm-hmm. And I basically rode their credibility through the first 3-4 years. I had very, very, very competent people that had been in the company for a very long time. So if you don't believe me in this, you do believe this guy. And you've worked with him for the last 15 years. So you know you can trust him. This is what we want to do. So I think I had a lot of borrowed credibility.
Of course.
So I had very good senior support and a lot of borrowed credibility to go with. And then, you know, you go with your skills and your persuasiveness and whatever's left there. But picking, and those were early decisions that I made because I could have chosen to bring people from the outside that had similar background to mine. But that wasn't my choice. I chose to recruit people from the inside because I understood that it was easier for me to transfer my background and my skill set and to coach people into learning things that they didn't know because the industry is not very good in brands in exchange for their internal credibility and their ability to teach me the business that I was in.
Of course.
So instead of bringing up whole bunch of new sort of people that were trained.
They look like you.
In a similar way.
They look
exactly.
like you. Yeah.
I recruit people that were very different background, and I learned from them. They learned from me, and together we built the credibility base.
Of course. Let me dive a little bit deeper into some of the challenges of any organization, right? Which is digital transformation, right? We know that. Especially with the last 18 months, digital transformation has accelerated years and has compressed into the last 18 months, right? What we were expecting to happen in the next 5 years probably started happening within 18 months. Has that been the same for your industry right now? Are there any new consumer behaviors that you're seeing that they weren't here 18 months ago?
I think our themes are similar to the themes of many other industries. What we saw is a change that was going to happen and that was happening get accelerated very, very quickly. So a big part of the change for us is very operational, but think about an internet company, a lot of what we do is you call us, you say you want internet, and then we send a guy or a gal, mostly guys, to your house to do some cable work in your home and get your internet, your TV working. And suddenly, that guy couldn't cross the threshold of your house. So that was a very violent change for us.
Of course.
Because we had to figure out how do we provide these services without coming into your house. And people were creative and we figured out ways and we became a lot better in people providing, being able to manage their own service and install their own stuff, all the way from being able to guide the customer virtually. First, the technician, like the first day, technicians are on FaceTime telling the customer, now standing on the outside of the house, telling the customer, do this, now do that, show me what you're seeing.
play by play, almost like a play by play.
Exactly. And these were the technicians using the FaceTime, right? Yeah. But that quickly evolved to a more systematic way to do that. So the provision of services in a way that's less physical was obviously a big jump. Obviously, the channel mix changed dramatically. So we sell our services on the phone, we sell our services in retail stores, and we sell our services online. And the transition from retail store and phone to online got quickly accelerated. And that was a not super easy, but a relatively easy thing to scale up because we were prepared. We had a good digital sales and service provision system, and it was just scaling it up. And all very beneficial to us. So because it's much cheaper to serve customers that way.
Okay.
So I say the same type of accelerations that the role of retail stores changed a little bit.
Of course, because you do have retail stores where people come in and they exchange equipment and they, or maybe subscribe to some of the services, right?
And that's exactly the change that happened. People used to use the retail stores more to go buy, explore. Stuff. So it was a sales location to some degree. Mm-hmm. Now it's much less so, and much more of a service provision location. So that's where you take your box, pick up a box, etc.
What about the customer journey? How's that changed because of digital transformation?
So chiefly a migration of volume. We had. For most things that you would want to do, so there are six journeys that cover most of your interactions with a company like ours. All of those journeys had a digital version and some form of either on the phone or on the phone and in retail store version. What happened is we already had those journeys in parallel. So say if you becoming a new customer, that's one of the journeys, right? You can become a new customer by calling, by showing up in a retail store, or by doing it online. We already had those three journeys available because we always were channel of choice. Like we want to serve you whatever channel you want to be served. What happened is a lot of the volume got moved from one channel to the other.
It was a rebalancing of channels.
But luckily, all of our digital journeys were ready. So this was a transfer of volume, but it didn't require to stand up. I'm maybe oversimplifying a little bit, but it didn't require to dramatically change our digital journeys. Our digital journeys were there, and they just were able to contain the new volume. Again, a few exceptions, like installing services when you can't cross a threshold, that required a new capability. For the most part, most journeys, we had a journey in a retail store, a journey over the phone, and a journey over digital, and a lot of the volume moved into digital.
Yeah.
So I'd say that's one change. Not a hard change for us. Another change that I think it's a very, very present challenge for anybody doing jobs like mine. It's one of my biggest challenges going forward is, I'm gonna tell you a little story. So a few weeks ago, I lost my wallet. Had never happened before, but I dropped my wallet somewhere, no wallet. Okay. I only have three things in my wallet. I have a credit card, I have the key to my car is a card. So the key to my car, my wallet, my credit card, and my driver's license. Those are the only three things in my wallet, and I lost all three. And I'm very upset when I get home because I think like, oh, this is going to be weeks of suffering. Just the idea of going to the DMV, getting a new license, this is going to be pain. Walk into my house and go on my phone, sitting in the kitchen, sit in the kitchen on my phone. I start by, how do you get a new driver's license? 5 minutes later, I had done everything I had to do online. Same thing with the car key. Same thing, the credit card immediately locked, immediately got a new card number. And my new card number, it got replaced in my Apple Pay. So I could go pay in places, even if it took about a week for my new card to get to me. My car keys, I bought two new car keys for $25. and I got them within the week at home. Meanwhile, I could open my car with my phone, so I didn't lose anything. I got a new driver's license a week later.
Yeah.
And I only did it in the phone. It cost me $5.
Yeah.
So $30, and a week later, I'm exactly in the same place, and most of my services were replaced immediately.
Isn't that incredible?
That's amazing.
It's amazing. That's amazing. I mean, that it's mind blowing. It's mind blowing how far we've moved. Yeah.
Now, think about what that means for a company like ours. This means that things that were acceptable for a customer only 2 years ago are completely unacceptable today.
Yeah.
So all of us, as people living in the world, have raised our quality standards dramatically.
Yeah.
So every time that the DMV manages to deliver a new driver's license within a week, this means that if you call me and tell me you want cable service, and I tell you that you have to wait a week for me to go install it, it's completely unacceptable. I mean, the DMV can beat me now.
Yeah.
So I think what happened is a massive raise in the quality standards that everyone expects, particularly with digital provisioning of services. So whatever improvement you made for your company, I am sure it's not enough.
Yeah,
because your customers expected a lot more.
Yeah, there is something about digital that I think crosses across all different verticals and industries and types of businesses. It doesn't matter if you're B2B or B2C or your service or your product, which is, in the past, customers didn't have control and they didn't have information, right? You as a brand or you as a service provider had control of the information. And you would communicate that through marketing campaigns or sales pitches or you know, documentation, whatever. You look at any business now, and what we have an abundance of is information. And we have not only information that is provided by the company, but now we have information that is provided by other users that had an experience with our brand, right? So what that creates is that you have to be way more proactive in providing solutions, because those standards that people had years ago are totally out of the window. Now people expect much more from brands and service providers, right? So I'll give you an example. My son has a moped, right? That is an electrical moped. And the battery blew out. I mean, we have to change the battery. It doesn't run the amount of time it should be running. I'm not going to say the brand because I don't want to burn them, but it's impossible to figure out how to change that battery. Right? I can take the battery, but how do I get the replacement? You know, what is the right battery? There's no information about it. Well, when you look at other brands, their competitors, they have YouTube videos explaining how to change it. They have lots of resources on how you can do it yourself. I mean, they just make it easy. Well, guess what? Next time I'm going to be thinking of one of these other brands, because they just allow me to have control over what I want to do with with this product or how to fix it. Right now I have to go back to this provider to overpay for a fix that I could have done myself, right? Because it's just changing a battery. So I think businesses that don't realize that going forward this is what customers will be expecting are going to start losing market share. Are going to start losing. Because by the way, you look for reviews and you look at Reddit comments, and everybody's killing this brand because everybody's having this experience. And if somebody's reading those comments before making a purchase decision, they're going to go with a competitor, right? So I think what you're describing is very, very key in the sense of going forward. If you haven't thought about that customer experience and those new customer expectations and behaviors, you're going to start seeing that in revenue numbers and in market share numbers.
Yeah, I think a related issue that we're dealing with as an industry, I would say, and I think a lot of companies are going to deal with, is when you think about reviews, right? You can serve 100 customers the right way. And if the 101 gets a negative experience, that's the customer that's going to give you a review.
Of course.
Right? So first is understanding that the power of the long tail of bad experiences is overweighted in your reviews online and the perception that your brand has online. Then Sandy, a long tail of bad experiences that you could ignore because it were a very small percentage of your customers. If you were satisfied, if you could hit 98% of your customers with good satisfaction, now that 2% has a voice and a very and a willingness to put their voice out there, so the 2% becomes a problem. How do you get rid of the tail? And I think that's created a very interesting relationship with complexity in general, complexity of your own offer, complexity of your own company. Because the truth is, any company, and I think most businesses have experienced this, you can always come up with an idea to launch a new product, a different version, a new price point, a new promotion, a new something, because there's a business case to any new thing that you do. But the more offers you have, the more price points you have, the more promotions you have, the more services you have, the more complexity you have, the more mistakes you're going to make. The more mistakes you make, the more you start feeding that long tail of customers that are sitting in that corner case where you thought of everything except this, right? So I think there was a time where customizing a lot and creating a lot of offerings and a lot of special things for different types of customers got you a lot of satisfaction from the majority of the customers because people wanted that customization. Now we're realizing that the complexity that comes with that also creates a long tail of highly unsatisfied customers that are very, very loud online. And the companies that manage to avoid that tend to be companies that have a very simple offering. So suddenly there's a lot to be said about this relationship between simplicity in your overall offering and operations and your reputation online, right? And companies that only have one price points, two price points. If you think about companies like Netflix, you know, anybody that has to deal with, say, ESPN, right? And you want to watch a game and you're traveling, and it's like a nightmare where you
are. Is it on ESPN Plus? Is it on ESPN?
Right. Yeah. It's like this complexity. Nobody can be happy with that. Whilst Netflix is one price, one offering, done, right? It's super simple. Of course, you're more likely to get less annoyed customers and what we call corner cases, right? Those are likely cases. So I like Formula One. I was in California this weekend. I wanted to watch a race. I pay for a subscription on a service. I can't watch it in California until 2 hours after the race. Yeah, that's a corner case. I realize not a lot of people in the US want to watch Formula One, but you and I will become a corner case at some point.
I mean, what you're describing is the nature of the new challenge, which is we used to be marketing to the biggest segment out there, right? So you would look at the biggest segment out there, and that's what your communication would be and your benefits would be. But now with digital access, really, what you have is a fragmented marketplace of very serious fans. So if you're a very serious fan of Formula One or a very serious fan of rugby or Premier League or whatever that is, you want to watch it when it's happening, right? And that's very important to you. And that's probably the reason why you subscribe to that service. So it's not acceptable for you to be told, oh, you cannot watch it now. You'll watch it in 2 hours when everybody else wakes up. Right. So I think that's a new behavior, a new expectation, but also it opens up the opportunity. I mean, it's a challenge for businesses, but it's also an opportunity, because if you could address all of those segments with what it's relevant for them at the time that it's relevant for them, you have a bigger business, you have a better business, you have more.
It's so
more
tricky, Gerardo, because there's a tension, right? On the one hand side, as customers, we are so picky about what we want, and we all are so special, and we want what we want, etc. But a company that tries to serve all of these very specific customized needs grows in complexity, and that goes in conflict with another thing that we want as customers. We want flawless service, like almost right is not good enough anymore. It has to be perfect, right? And I think that you know, there's this old probably 15, 20 year old idea of the paradox of choice, right? And I think it's all of this is breathing new life into thinking about the paradox of choice, the idea that people say that they want choice, but they're actually less happy when choice is given many times, right?
Of course.
And then there's
been a lot of stories about that.
Indeed.
It shows that when you give people choice, they stop choosing because there's a paralysis going on because now you're making the best choice.
Right. So I think on the one hand, people tell you they want all these very special things, etc. And on a digital platform, you can fragment your service to meet all of these special needs. On the other hand, the more you do that, the more complex you become, the more you're going to make mistakes and create this long tail of unhappy customers that don't get exactly what they hope for. Mm-hmm. And then the third sort of leg of this stool is knowing that although people ask for choice, when they get choice, they may be less happy with choice. I think you look at brands, I think it's a very interesting brand like Tesla, that, you know what, they give you no choice. There's no choice. I don't know anybody that's gone through the experience of buying and owning a Tesla. You make five decisions online, and you bought a car. It takes 10 minutes to buy a car. You've only made five decisions. But the truth is, they're giving you no choice. The thing is what it is. They're going to give it to you whenever they want. They're going to give it to you where they want. There's no negotiating the price, zero choice, zero mistakes. It's perfect, no choice. And if having no choice doesn't work for you, then you're not a Tesla customer. End of story. Go move somewhere else. There you see a company taking a stand and saying, you know what, I'm going to reduce choice so that I can provide a flawless car with flawless service, and just accept that a lot of customers are not going to be okay with that. You know, Apple brought that to the personal computing thing many years ago, the idea that, you know, they only had a very reduced number of choices, and, you know, either like that or go buy somewhere else.
Of course.
So there's a lot to be said, I think, for when offered the opportunity with digital platforms to do high customization and a lot of segmentation and very sophisticated fancy footwork, there's a lot to be said for brands that say, you know what, I'm not going to do any of that. I'm going to do one very simple, very clear thing, and I'm going to make it flawless so that people that want it love it and let anybody else go buy something else.
Sure.
So I think those are choices that we marketers are given now that are new and interesting and very strategic and important choices for our brands.
Yeah, and I think as I hear you talking about this, is I think the challenge is to identify where is the line, right? What is the balance, the right balance? Because obviously with digital, you have the ability to hyper segment. And probably there's a case for doing much better segmentation and a much better customization of products and services. But to your point, at what point do we stop, right? At what point it becomes diminishing returns? Because now we are getting into a level of complexity that we cannot service, that is going to start making mistakes, that is going to start being expensive to support, right? I think there isn't... I think the Tesla example is, you know, that you describe, it's an extreme in the sense because it's a brand that can afford to do that, right? And also it's a product, right? So I understand with products, I mean, you have inventories, you have so many different things that you have to take into account that actually a reduction of choice, it's an improvement to your bottom line in the sense that now you're much more efficient in managing all of your chain, production chain. When it comes to intangibles, when it comes to digital services, where it's really everything is automated, right? Because you've already have it in a database somewhere in the cloud. It's just about connecting everything in a way that it's delivering a service that somebody wants. You're not getting a benefit of that inventory management, but you really want to avoid creating something so complex that you can't support, that will create negative experiences, and that those negative experiences will result in bad reviews, and if worse, in churn, right?
Yeah, although, you know, you can argue that there's a customer for that too. I also went through the experience of buying a Jeep. You know, that's exactly the opposite. It's a terrible buying experience, incredibly confusing. Nothing of what you want is available. You have to deal with dealers that you have to negotiate everything. They won't give you information over the phone. You have to actually drive 40 minutes to their place if you want to know anything worth knowing. None of the cars, that they have huge supply chain issues. So now it's almost impossible to get a car. There's a fan base for Jeeps that are as enthusiastic as Tesla drivers are out there. So I think that we have to understand that there are customers that are willing to, by the way, a very low quality car, but a very strong brand, right? There's a customer for a really low quality service and low quality product, but that appreciate all the high customization. Mm-hmm. And that's what they pay for, and they pay, you know, whatever, $40,000 for a very bad car that is exactly the way they wanted it to be, with all the little customization things that they wanted. And there's a customer that pays $40,000 for a car that is exactly what it is, and they got no choices. They just chose one of four colors, right?
And that's where the value of the brand is, right? Because, I mean, probably the customer that is purchasing that Jeep is purchasing that brand because it reflects something about their personality.
An expression, right? Of identity, absolutely.
And it's an expression of identity, and that's where the value of all of that brand marketing is coming through, even though the product is not up to par with what it should be. Listen, I know that you have to run. You're a very busy man. I just wanted to ask you, I know you wanted to talk when we did the prep call to this podcast, you wanted to talk about a topic that it's very close to your heart, which is creating brand alignment with employees at scale. How do you move a massive organization into following a new brand path, right? I mean, you come in, you build this, you know, this brand, but that brand is really the experience of the customer touch points, right? Because it's not something that people are going to buy. It's something that people are going to experience. So give me a couple of minutes on how do you achieve that? You know, what are the key challenges for somebody in the audience that is thinking, that is joining a job, that's thinking about building, you know, kind of like doing this brand development, but they still need to align a large organization around delivering that brand promise.
Right. I don't know that I can say how you do it every time. Like I can say how it happened for
us, of course.
At Cox, right? So we as I said, at the starting point 7 years ago, we were a company name, but not a brand. So the first thing is to decide, okay, what kind of brand we are, and we made that choice. And we made that choice looking at two reference points. One reference point, of course, was the customer and the market, and what was a more effective way to position our brand there. We understood that most brands that we compete with are all about technology and speed and edge and sort of very cold and very sort of very heavy on electrons and low on humanity. Mm-hmm. And we decided we're going to be the opposite of that, because there's a room for us to be a different thing in the market. So we're all about warm and fuzzy, and we have a brand belief. We believe that life is better with more moments of real human connection, and we encourage people to use our internet and our products in an intentional way to create moments of human connection. So mm-hmm. So we bring a lot of warmth into a market that it's all about megabytes and speed and sort of colder things. Mm-hmm. And that was one reference point, is the consumer and the market and the external world. But the other reference point was the company itself. Mm-hmm. I work at a company that has a very strong, very, very strong culture. We are a very relationship-driven company. We are a very human company. We're very human to each other. Employees are really nice to each other. We're good at listening to each other. We're gentle and we're considerate and we're compassionate to each other. People come into meetings with the agenda that they have, and you know what the agenda is. Nobody's hiding anything. And people always assume good intent from anywhere else, anyone else. So we are a very human and very warm company. So there's this clear alignment between the positioning that we want to go after out there and the internal culture and the experience that people have of the internal culture. People that work for Cox are very loyal, and they're very loyal because they feel the company is a warm place that takes care of them. So finding that point of alignment between the positioning of the company, of the brand, and the true culture of the company gives you the ability to align service with brand, right? So if we want the brand to show up as a warm, caring, human brand, it's not hard to do because we're a warm, caring, human culture. So in some ways, this was about asking people to be who we are in front of the customer. So there's a very short step when a customer service representative feels supported, cared for, feels that it's led by compassionate people, feels that it's invited to be his or her own whole self at work, and feels connected to everybody around them. When you ask them, behave that way towards the customer, be yourself, ask questions, get to know the person that you're talking to, be compassionate, figure out what they need, and help them in a compassionate way. It comes out of the heart. It's not difficult.
Yeah, because it's part of the brand essence. It's part of the cultural essence. It sounds to me that the brand essence, it's infused with the culture itself. And then it's not difficult to connect the dots and align people that way.
I'd say it's still hard, but it's less difficult.
If
you can thread sort of perfectly align, or as much as you can align, the culture of the company, the brand positioning, and the customer experience that you want to create. If those three are well aligned, then it's much easier to sort of thread those three needles with one thread, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, fascinating, Gaston. Listen, I know that that we had until 10 today to talk. I appreciate your time. I mean, this has been a fascinating conversation. I think I could have spoken with you for another hour about this. You're obviously a very experienced guy, but also you're great at explaining and describing things. And I appreciate your time. I appreciate also the fact that I had the chance to not only interview here, but also collaborate with you on a couple of of projects in a pro bono way. I mean,
in the nonprofit world, you have done great work. I also work at the Latin American Association and on the board, and you've done phenomenal work for us.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, I appreciate
it. Grateful.
I appreciate the invitation to help you with that. Listen, thank you so much. I hope our audience learns a lot from this experience. Anybody out there, if you ever want to connect with somebody that it's a great marketeer, look for Gaston on LinkedIn and connect with him and, build his audience. Gaston, thank you so much. And if you're okay with it, we'll want to have you for another episode one of these days.
I'll be happy to. It's always a pleasure to see you, Gerardo.
Thank you so much. Have a good day, okay?
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Hi everyone, welcome to Embracing Change. In this episode, I talked to Gaston Baneri, Senior Vice President of Brands at Cox Communications, about some of the challenges established brands have in mobilizing internal resources to respond to changes in the marketplace. We discussed many topics,
from mapping a customer's journey to the complexities of translating brand values into the user experience. I hope you enjoy it.